On this week's Encrypted Economy, we had Rihanna Pfefferkorn from Stanford Internet Observatory to talk about privacy and encryption. The timing was actually really good. In early June, a couple weeks ago, the Supreme Court decided the Van Buren case, which raises some interesting questions around the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, which is basically a federal anti-hacking statute. At issue, essentially, was a police officer who had abused his position to collect data on a subject in exchange for a payment from a private party. And we'll get more into that into this episode, as well as the challenges that encryption has and continues to face as a technology. And I guess it all really depends on where you sit and your view on it. Despite the title of this episode, it's not a loaded deck. This is not simply an episode that's advocating for limits to be placed on the critical public good that law enforcement either delivers or is empowered to deliver to society. But let me start off by framing this issue. Would you want law enforcement to be able to enter your house when you are not home to look for evidence? Now, you might correctly say, hey, they'd need a warrant for that. And why are you bringing this up? Well, I'm going to build on that. What about if they had unconsensual access to the data on your phone? Well, they would also need a warrant for that. If they wanted to access your computer files, they want to access your phone records, they didn't have your consent, they would need a warrant. But let's go a little deeper. Let's say that suddenly law enforcement required all lock manufacturers and alarm makers to include a back door. Basically, any lock could be unlocked with a specific key, and all lock manufacturers had to abide by it. And every alarm company had to give a code to law enforcement, and all had to abide by it. And let's even say that they even went a step further, just to be silly, and they had a special mist for a dog that might bark, right? So you say, well, what's the difference? If they had a warrant, they'd be just doing their job. Well, it raises one question. Obviously, law enforcement, like the Van Buren case, they could be abusing that privilege or that right. But let's go to the next level. Let's say that those in the alarm and lock manufacturers, they could abuse it. Maybe they could even sell it to criminals. They say, hold it, the U.S. government can make that illegal. And they could. Now, also, criminals, bad actors, know that there is this feature in the locks, in the alarms, put the dog to the side. Maybe they hire people from these spaces. Maybe they find that back door in. Maybe they get better positioned to use this lock and this alarm code wherever they want to break into somebody's house. And let's even take it one step further. What if these companies were restricted in the U.S.? The U.S. prohibited the use of this key or this alarm code by anyone except law enforcement. Would it change things? Now these lock and alarm manufacturers then sold this to repressive regimes who could abuse it. Does this matter? Is there something fundamentally wrong about mandating that our home needs to be able to be made insecure in this example and trust a process to enforce it that can't possibly capture everything? So these are some of the issues, same issues that arise when we contemplate how to grapple with the competing concerns of privacy and security. So on this episode, we talk about these and other privacy and censorship issues with Rihanna, and I hope you'll enjoy it. Also, of course, if you like the show, please like it, share it, tell us about it, give us comments. At any rate, with this, I give you our episode with Rihanna Pfefferkorn. Welcome to the Encrypted Economy, where we look at the business of regulation and security for all things encrypted, digital assets, blockchain technology, privacy, and smart contracts. Hope you'll join us while we explore these forces that are shaping the economy. All right, so this is Eric Hess with the Encrypted Economy, and today I am excited to have Rihanna Pfefferkorn on the podcast. Now, Rihanna is a research scholar at Stanford's Internet Observatory, a lab dedicated to the study of disruptive technologies and policy engagement with an aim of understanding the impact of those developments on our governments and society. I'm not going to go further into your background because I'm going to ask you to, but Rihanna, welcome to the show. I'm excited to have you on.
Thank you for having me here, Eric.
So, you know, the encrypted economy, we've had some privacy guests on. We've done a fair amount on crypto and privacy enhancing technologies. But, you know, I think we need a little bit more of what we're doing today, which is getting into some of the more U.S. policy centric privacy implications and looking at some of what's gone on in the privacy space. And you're a perfect person to help us through that. But before we begin, do you want to give us a bit of a background on how you got to where you are and what your mission is now?
Yeah, sure. So I am a lawyer by training. I've been at Stanford for about 5.5 years now. And for the first 5 of those years, I was at the law school before switching over to SIO. I became a lawyer because of an interest that I picked up during college about the intersection between technology and civil liberties. And that was what incentivized me to follow that path to law school at the University of Washington School of Law in the great city of Seattle, and afterwards to spend some time clerking and then a few years at a tech-focused big law firm here in the Bay Area before, you know, finally making the leap to find the rare position out there that actually would fulfill that combination of interest, that particular intersection between, you know, essentially surveillance and freedom of expression type issues with emerging technologies. And, you know, the position I have now is supposed to be a 1-year fellowship at a place called the Center for Internet and Society at the law school. And I just kind of didn't leave, like a cat that comes around that you feed, and now it's your cat. So, you know, I'm Stanford's cat now, I guess.
Was when you transitioned from a from a big law firm to your current role, was that a challenging transition or was it a sigh of relief?
I mean, it's a big change of pace, you know, the long hours and the late nights and the weekends. I remember my very first day that I arrived, my then boss, Jennifer Granick, who's now at the ACLU, she couldn't be there that day. She had some meeting that she couldn't move. So she sent me an email with a list of the things that she wanted me to do, but she didn't include a time frame for it. And having been trained up by big law, I just thought, I need to do all of these things today. So I stayed late. I left the office at around 9 o'clock at night and, you know, had sent her like an update with everything. And I said, you know, I'm available to talk by phone if you want to discuss, which is just standard, you know, in big law. You always offer to be available no matter what time of day or night it is. And she sent an email back that just said, I don't want to talk to you at 9 o'clock at night about work. You're in academia now. You don't have to work like this anymore. And I was like, oh, okay. So, you know, it was a little bit of a transition period. I definitely find the academic pace to be more amenable to work-life balance. And that's something I really appreciate. It certainly feels like it's less actual hands-on lawyering oriented because it's a bit more at a remove. It's more sort of broad-based policy type considerations. And there's certainly some parts about that part of the job that I do miss. But overall, you know, I've found Stanford to be a great place to work. Terrific colleagues, top-notch people, especially since the launch of the Internet Observatory 2 years ago. I'm really happy to be there.
And so the Internet Observatory, what is the mission and how does it differ from the Center for Internet and Society?
So I would say maybe it's about what the focus is. You know, you did a good job reading out the description of, you know, what the Internet Observatory is. It's supposed to be cross-disciplinary. We have people who come from computer science, from the social sciences, from government. I was the first person with a legal background to join. And it's trying to study the abuse in information technologies, especially the internet, especially social media. I would say that the Center for Internet and Society looks at the same sort of phenomena and technologies, but I think maybe comes at it with a really sort of central, you know, civil liberties and human rights type focus. And here, I think the focus is instead on kind of the phenomena rather than the underlying, you know, coming through a particular lens or a particular value system to look at a lot of kind of the same issues. And so I think it was a really natural transition for me to come over from CIS to the Internet Observatory, especially where, you know, honestly, the focus on abuse at the Internet Observatory can be a little bit of a downer. And so coming in as the resident encryption policy expert, I always like to at least try to remind, you know, all involved of the benefits, you know, of new technologies and the benefits of encryption in particular, rather than only focusing on the abuse.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. And that's something that the encrypted economy is part of our theme, right? So I warned you a little bit about the a noteworthy value-shaping personal experience. Have you conjured up one to share?
It's funny. It's so much like writing the personal statement for applying to college, you know? And yeah,
flashback.
Yeah, exactly right. I think it goes back a little bit to what I was saying about how I got interested in college in this particular intersection. It was from over the summer before my last fall in college, I volunteered at the Electronic Frontier Foundation here in San Francisco. You know, I was living a little south of San Francisco at the time. It was someplace that I could take public transit up to and have something to do during the summer. And I didn't know any lawyers. I had never had interactions with the legal system. So I just had a picture of lawyers as, you know, stodgy people in stodgy offices doing stodgy things. And so encountering a group of people who were working on cutting edge, you know, digital rights issues and, you know, had long hair and tie-dye t-shirts. I was like, oh, there are cool lawyers. I didn't know lawyers could be cool. And, you know, the kind of work that they did then and that they still do now, you know, almost 20 years later, was just such an interesting, totally new field. I think that the internet is in a much different place today than it was at the time when I was still young and naive, but as were we all, I guess, about what the internet would become. It was such an inspiration to say, oh, there are people who can work on the things that are being invented here in Silicon Valley, and then tackle the issues that arise from that with respect to people's privacy, with respect to people's right to free speech online, with respect to all of the values that make up a democratic society.
Excellent. So in preparing for our episode today, I was going through all the things you've written about and all the different things that are current. And I thought to myself, holy crap, there's a lot of stuff here. This is going to be phenomenal. I figure we'll start with first things first, which is the Van Buren Supreme Court decision. So the Supreme Court, June 3rd, issued their decision in Van Buren versus the United States. It was the court's first ever interpretation of the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, CFAA, which is basically a federal anti-hacking statute. Basically, it presented the question of whether somebody exceeds authorized access under the CFAA by accessing a computer in violation of an authorized purpose, such as providing a computer use policy of an employer or website's term of services. So what happened there, and why is this a really important decision for privacy advocates?
Everybody who works in computer security, people who work on criminal law, people who work on various areas of research, both in computer science and outside of that in the social sciences as well, were breathlessly waiting to see what would come out of this decision, because we had a split among the various courts of appeals across the country, which was why the Supreme Court decided to take this case up, as to whether the CFAA should be interpreted very broadly or very narrowly. There have been some courts that have adopted the broad view advocated in some high-profile prosecutions and by private plaintiffs that really go beyond what you accurately identified is the core purpose of the CFAA, which is to prohibit computer hacking. And yet, we'd seen the law used to punish people for things that went far afield from that, in cases commonly to punish departing employees who access information after they've left to try and build up a competing business, or other types of competitor situations, or cyberbullying before cyberbullying laws were really on the books. It had been used in all of these different ways. And the breadth of the language and the sort of shifting requirements of what kind of access do you have and what's the mens rea that's attached to it, and then what kind of damage or loss as defined by the statute happens as a result of that, had given such a broad ambit of potential for prosecution for liability under that law that it had been a source of significant trouble, both to folks like computer security researchers, for example, who had to be afraid that if they colored outside the lines one whit, that they would find themselves being arrested on federal felonies, even as white hat researchers trying to improve the state of computer security, ranging all the way to, and this came up in the court's opinion, because some courts had interpreted the law to include violations of acceptable use policies or of terms of service. Now, suddenly, anytime you fib about your height on a dating profile, now you're a federal felon, right? Under this law, that's goes pretty far from the central concern about making it illegal to hack and damage computer systems. And so when the court issued this opinion, a lot of us really breathed a sigh of relief, because it pretty clearly sides with courts of appeals, including the Ninth Circuit, where I live, that have said, no, you cannot turn a violation of a private policy that is subject to change at any time, and allow, you know, private drafters to hold in their hands the power to turn conduct that goes beyond those terms into a federal crime. And so, you know, anytime you're sharing Netflix passwords now, at least, you know, it may be a breach of contract, but maybe it's not at least a federal crime anymore. So this should do a lot to make research a lot safer, both for computer security and for the kinds of security that had been conducted by social scientists, where, for example, they wanted to research whether there was housing discrimination or job discrimination on various housing and employment websites. But the possibility of creating a bunch of sock puppets and fake job postings or fake housing postings could have potentially opened them up to liability if the reigning interpretation of the law was that violating a terms of service that says, you know, no sock puppet accounts or whatever is a violation of the act. So it brought a lot more certainty by bringing a lot more narrowness, I think, to the law. And so that's overall a really good decision from the court. The court did leave open in a particular footnote some language that seemed to go against the grain of exactly what the ruling had been, and introduced a certain amount of confusion of, well, we're not saying that we're saying what we're saying about, you know, whether you need to have only a technical type of access breach rather than a breach of a policy-based control or a gate in the language of the court. And we all said, well, I thought that's exactly what you're saying throughout the rest of this opinion. So now, you know, at least it's, as usual, the Supreme Court has a way of snatching defeat from the jaws of victory in terms of leaving something unresolved that will allow for the full employment of lawyers for years to come. So I think we can still look forward to seeing the courts try and figure out now what this means, in particular in a case about data scraping that had come out of the Ninth Circuit that had sought cert at the Supreme Court, called HiQ v. LinkedIn, which now the court has remanded back down to the Ninth to consider in light of its Van Buren decision. And so it sort of feels like, you know, okay, we put this confusing footnote in the Van Buren CFA opinion. Now it's up to you to go guess what we meant, and then maybe we'll tell you if you guessed right. So that's going to be another one to watch around the scope of rights and defenses and liability for scrapers.
So Van Buren was a little ironic, though, in some ways, in that it's a victory for privacy advocates, but yet it's also, the case itself is kind of demonstrative of, you know, should we be putting all our trust into law enforcement agencies? Like, oh, if we give them these powers, you know, we can trust them, right? Meaning, you know, in terms of, like, you know, law enforcement is only going to use our private data for the good of society. But Van Buren was actually a demonstrative case of where that was not the case. He was a police officer, I believe, that was getting paid to provide information to a private citizen. So well outside the realm of his job or what you would trust a law enforcement officer to do. But so that's demonstrative of the risks, but yet it was the right result because he wasn't actually hacking. He actually had access to it. It was an abuse of his authority, but it wasn't him extending it beyond what he was otherwise permitted to do. But yet still kind of ironic, right?
It is. No, you make an excellent point. Yeah. And so the Supreme Court came down, I think, the correct way in reinforcing a line that some courts had drawn between improper access to data, which is what the CFA is about, and improper use of that data, an improper purpose for accessing the data, which is a separate issue in which the court clarified is not a violation of the act. But you are right in that it sort of points to the fact that, for all that there's been a lot of talk, and we're going to get into this among law enforcement about needing to have access for investigatory purposes to data about people, this illustrates the dangers that can happen and the limitations on how much we can necessarily trust that access won't be misused subsequently. And that's exactly what, you know, I keep front of mind in a lot of my advocacy and writing on encryption policy, because if you can have some sort of technical enforcement around access, which is what encryption provides to keep out hackers and cyber criminals and adversarial foreign governments and so forth, then you don't have to worry about what use they want to make about it.
Right. So, and yeah, we'll certainly get into it. So what are some of the most pressing policy issues in the encryption space right now, and how does what we're experiencing today, and now you're also going to have to do a little bit of backdrop for that, how does this compare to the crypto wars of the 1990s? I guess you have to introduce the crypto wars in the 1990s first and then get into the comparison.
So the crypto wars of the 90s were about overly restrictive export controls on encryption technologies that basically treated crypto the same as ammunition, like a bomb. It was listed as ammunition and controlled for export in the same way. Eventually, by the end of the 90s, those regulations got relaxed. There are still export restrictions, but they are classified under the Department of Commerce now, rather than being treated as a weapon. So that is a benefit. There was also some battles in the 90s over how to treat code. And code, finally, you know, we've recognized now that it's a form of speech, that computer code can be speech, and that the ability, restrictions on the ability to teach cryptography to, for example, foreign students from countries where export of cryptography or other munitions is precluded, that is a free speech issue. And so we had cases where there were professors who wanted to teach cryptography or to share software with their students and were afraid that they might violate the law by doing so. And, you know, we were talking at the time about an era that predates the rise of encrypting everything, encrypting web traffic, of having portable mobile devices that are encrypted, of having laptops that can be encrypted at the full disk level. So we were sort of looking forward to, I guess, the era that we have today. We would not have the encrypted economy that we have today had it not been for changes in the law, at least in the United States, back in the 90s, to relax those and to make possible a world where encryption technologies are in the hands of anybody other than the government, the military, and financial institutions, which was really kind of where encryption got its start in the 70s. And so by passing rules and regulations in the 90s, both by relaxing crypto export controls and by passing a federal law that mandated access to by law enforcement to telecommunications networks, but exempted the internet and exempted, you know, computers and mobile devices and so forth, that was what allowed the rise of what we have today, where we have Signal and iMessage and WhatsApp and your encrypted iPhone and your encrypted Android phone. We wouldn't necessarily have those had the law not changed in the 90s. And so we're operating now in the policy sphere when it comes to encryption, kind of from the reverse, where it used to be, you know, we couldn't have nice things and we were fighting to be able to have nice things. Now we have the nice things, and there are elements of government, both in the United States and in other countries, that are trying to take those away because basically the technology caught up with the policy and the law. It wasn't even really an issue to worry about the state of the law so much, at least with regard to just average consumers like you and me, until we all had these devices in our pockets and until all of our web traffic was encrypted and until it was easy and free to be able to encrypt your communications without having to fiddle around with an external drive or without having to install and configure special software or use PGP. The usability has and the default nature of encrypting our devices and communications is really what has caused this revolution in, you know, data privacy and security, but that has brought with it a concomitant trade-off in terms of law enforcement access, where it used to be that they could easily get access to information off of your phone, off of your laptop, be able to intercept your communications, because those things were not encrypted in a way that, you know, there was no way for them to get access to it. Now that that is the case, now they are sort of going back to the same arguments that they had been making a quarter century ago about going dark due to encryption and, you know, being left in the dark in terms of their investigative capabilities. And there's just a lot more people who are able to use encryption a lot more easily to protect their devices and communications. And so that is really what has given law enforcement so much concern, is that it's no longer just the sophisticated criminals who were always able to use those technologies and had the incentive to fiddle around with non-user-friendly pieces of software or devices. Now it's everybody.
Right. And we've gone from trying to ban it, which was probably very short-sighted at the time, or limit it to being a military secret, to law enforcement wanting to have their own little backdoors and access to it. So, hey, this is, now that it's out, we want special privileges to peek in. So, I mean, and that sort of leads into some things that you've been active on, which is the Lawful Access to Encrypted Data, or LAED, which doesn't really pronounce very well, or Eliminating Abusive and Rampant Neglect of Interactive Technologies, That one leads to earn it, which I like it, although it has nothing to do with earning really anything. And, you know, what's interesting is particularly the lawful access to encrypted data, and you can maybe correct me as a historian on this, it actually seems like it contains themes that are very similar to Senator Joe Biden's bill in 1991, that encryption that didn't provide government access should be outlawed. And here we are with Lindsey Graham, sort of two polar sides of the aisle. But I mean, is that correct that we have Joe Biden sponsoring this in 1991 and then fast forward to 2020, you got Lindsey Graham also saying this is something we got to have?
I mean, it really shows how at times it can feel like we're treading water when it comes to encryption policy, because it feels like we're having the same arguments over and over and over and over again. And, you know, as a policy advocate, that can be frustrating. I would love to have no more job security, for this to just finally be put to bed and for us to just accept that, you know, encryption provides, at least to my mind, more benefits than harms, and that there are other ways of trying to address those harms. And so rather than undermining security for everybody, which is what a backdoor would end up doing, we need to just live with it. We live in a different world than we were in 30 years ago. But you also highlight how this can be potentially a very bipartisan issue. The previous time before last year that we had seen a bill that touched upon access to encrypted data had been in 2016, where it never actually got formally introduced, but there was a bill that had been co-authored by a Republican senator, Senator Burr from North Carolina, and my senator, Dianne Feinstein, a Democrat from San Francisco, that would have imposed penalties for selling smartphones that couldn't be decrypted for law enforcement. The Earn It Act bill that you mentioned as well had a lot of bipartisan support. It passed out of the Senate committee last summer, didn't get to a full floor consideration in the Senate, got introduced in a slightly amended version in the House, and didn't go anywhere before the end of the previous Congress. Fortunately, knock wood, neither of those bills has been reintroduced yet, either the LAED Act, which just is not easy to say, or the Earn It bill, but that doesn't necessarily mean that they won't be reintroduced. Both of those pose different kinds of threats to the ability of American companies and companies doing business in America to offer strong encryption and the best possible security to their customers. And it seems, and what I really just don't know is whether members of Congress and their staff don't understand that the ideal world they want of a golden key that only unlocks the bad guys' information or only unlocks the information they need just isn't possible, or whether they understand the trade-offs and they just don't necessarily care. And we've seen different attitudes from top officials in the FBI and the Department of Justice over time with regard to that. Some have been much more equivocating than others. Bill Barr, really, the gloves came off and he was like, yeah, I understand that this makes security worse for everybody. Deal with it. You know, and that was kind of the attitude that he took. It remains to be seen what this administration will do, but we have some early kind of troubling signs. You know, you mentioned that this was what Joe Biden had said 30 years ago. There are plenty of issues on which Joe Biden would now say, well, my views have changed and evolved since then. But even in a joint statement coming out of the G7 meeting just a few days ago, there was, you know, a brief passage in there that has alarmed a lot of privacy and civil liberties advocates and encryption policy advocates that seem to talk about working together to maintain, you know, lawful access to communications in law enforcement investigations. And we all sort of looked at this sideways and said, are they talking about encryption backdoors? What do they mean? You know, we had been hoping to see a commitment among, you know, leading democracies of the world to protect encryption and to promote encryption. And instead, we get this language that is sort of casting a pall and saying, huh, maybe the new boss is kind of the same as the old boss when it comes to the encryption fight. Obama was not, you know, never came out one way or the other, kind of said some not so great things about encryption and access to data, never actually pushed the issue one way or the other. And now that his vice president is the president, it's not necessarily clear that we're going to see anything stronger in terms of protecting encryption, despite the fact that cybersecurity overall has emerged as a clear priority for this administration at all levels across multiple agencies as a funding priority, because we're dealing with such an epidemic now of hacks and data breaches and, you know, security vulnerabilities and ransomware and so forth. Not all of those are necessarily things that, you know, more and better encryption are going to resolve, but at least it seems like if, to the extent that encryption is like one of the best tools we have for protecting data security, it seems like maybe we shouldn't be weakening that one when we need, you know, all the help we can get in the fight to better protect Americans' data security.
Right. Strengthen it versus actually having a federally managed mandate to create a vulnerability that only the federal government will have and no bad guy will ever get a hold of, because no one will be able to figure that one out if they know it exists, right?
It's a mess, exactly.
Seems like a good plan. You know, I mean, and listen, I think it's, there's always this force, you know, between those who want total privacy, right, or privacy, versus those who want the assurances of security or absolute security. I think I read a quote somewhere that absolute security requires totalitarianism, while total privacy creates anarchy. But the truth is really somewhere maybe in the middle, or honestly, probably more so on the privacy side, because to the extent you're giving up your privacy to any single entity, as Van Buren illustrates, you know, you're certainly creating the risk of abuse. And you know, I guess that leads me to another question, which is from the American people perspective, you know, the general population in America, do they get it? Do they really care? Do they care about it more when they fear that the political party in power might be abusing it? Or, you know, do they care about potential abuse by authoritarian regimes accessing this information? Or does it seem too distant? Like, what do you think, you know, how do you contrast like the American view versus the European view, which seems to be much more focused on privacy? And why do you think there's that difference?
It's a great question. And, you know, I don't know necessarily that the average American person just understands all of the nuances about encryption policy that I've been soaking in up to my eyeballs, you know, for a half of a decade at this point. But, you know, that's, they benefit from it anyway, without even needing to know about all of the crypto wars and going all the way back to the 1970s up to today. Anybody who has an iPhone or an Android phone, anybody who is surfing the web now that, you know, we have near ubiquitous encryption of web traffic, anybody who's talking on WhatsApp to their loved ones is benefiting from encryption, whether they understand the trade-offs, the security issues, the law enforcement issues, the privacy issues, or whether they have no idea and they're just trying to go about their lives, which is, you know, most people are just trying to get through the day without having technology get in their way, and preferably would have it help them out. You know, we see a lot of talk about how people don't want privacy, they don't need it, they don't ask for it. And that seems like, you know, that's always, it seems like an oversimplification to me, where depending on how you ask people or what kind of trade-offs you're making, you might get a different answer. One of the things that I think helped to shape the landscape of the encryption debate very heavily was the Apple versus the FBI dispute in early 2016, only fairly soon after I had started this job. You know, when I left my firm, I said, I'm going to go work on cryptography policy. Everybody said, crypto what? What are you talking about? And then as soon, you know, 6 months later, once the Apple versus FBI dispute was on the front page of every newspaper in America and on the evening news, everybody knew what I meant. And, you know, it was rare that that kind of dispute gets fought out in public court. Normally, those kinds of things happen in sealed proceedings that happen in secret and aren't on the front page of the newspaper. And I think my guess is that the Department of Justice had picked that battle with Apple in public because they thought that they would have public opinion on their side. They were investigating a mass shooting in San Bernardino, California, that at the time was the worst terror attack on U.S. soil since 9/11. And I think it may have taken them by surprise to find that, you know, when people realize that you're talking about getting into my phone, but it's my phone, it has all of my most secret and private stuff on there. I think they didn't necessarily expect for public opinion to be as divided and for there to be as much support for Apple as there turned out to be. It wasn't 100% on Apple's side, but it wasn't 100% on the DOJ's side either. You know, it turned out that just invoking the specter of terrorism didn't necessarily do their job for them in terms of winning over the public, when people, you know, by now do have so much of their lives lived online and stored in the devices we carry everywhere in our pockets. And so I think, you know, at least even in the United States, people do understand, you know, and want privacy. It does look a little different, I think, from Europe, where Europe, I think, now is grappling with having to confront the, you know, that they have a much more fundamental approach to privacy as a fundamental right. They passed the GDPR that came into effect a couple of years ago. And it really revolutionized the way that companies have to handle and deal with users' data. But they're now encountering friction between the privacy protective side of European law and the needs of law enforcement. And sometimes those things have come into head-to-head and locking antlers, where it just seems like it wasn't necessarily the case that when they drafted the GDPR, that they had made as much of a provision or consulted the stakeholders from the law enforcement side of things as they perhaps ought to have. So maybe it goes a bit more the other direction there, where they had focused so much on privacy that they had given short shrift to law enforcement. Whereas here, it feels like we tend to center law enforcement's needs in the conversation and center those above the needs of the economy, of national security, of individual rights and privacy, and of, you know, just other loosey-goosey West Coast type values that I could, you know, go off about.
I think, you know, Apple is a really good example, because when talking even about, hey, how do people, you know, what's the populace's perception, American populace's perception on privacy? Privacy is sort of an a fuzzy concept to a lot of people. Like, I understand I want my right to be private, but when you start to break it down, like, do you want somebody jailbreaking your phone, or law enforcement having the ability to see your messages, or just to sort of search your messages randomly if they suspect you? And, you know, do you have the trust that everybody who's going to be looking at that is only going to be using it for defined purposes? And how else could it be used? And could it lead to surveillance and you know, subtle surveillance and people, you know? So I think when you start to break it down into what are some of the, you know, what are the specific rights and that whole web, I think, you know, people start to have a very different view. You ask an average American, do you think there should be some sacrifices in privacy to ensure security? Most people say, well, I guess so. But then, you know, by the same token, you ask the question differently, like, well, you know, should law enforcement be able to look at everything in your phone to ensure security? To your point, they'd be like, no, that's ridiculous. Why would they do that? That's an invasion of my privacy. So the answer is very different depending on how you frame it. And your example was great for that. So I actually had read your blog post, which is what drew me to you, how I learned of you. You wrote a blog post about, and I think it's a great example of this conflict and how it even plays out in sort of the private sector, wherein you talk about Celebrate and Signal and their dispute. Now, a lot of people aren't going to be familiar with it. So maybe you could summarize the issue and how it played out and some of the concerns that it raised along the way.
Sure. So you may be familiar with Signal. It's an end-to-end encrypted chat app that exists within, you know, sort of a flourishing, wonderful, you know, let a thousand flowers bloom industry of end-to-end encrypted chat apps, where you either your communications are end-to-end encrypted by default, meaning that not even the organization that provides the app here, that's the foundation behind Signal, or in the case of WhatsApp, that's Facebook, for example, not even they can read your messages. Signal stores way less information than most other apps do, and that means that they have less to hand over to law enforcement, which means that the primary way for law enforcement to get access to your Signal messages is by having your phone. The thing about end-to-end encryption is that it encrypts between the ends, but your phone is one end and the other person's phone is the other end. And so if law enforcement can get a warrant and get into your phone, then they'll be able to potentially see your Signal messages if you don't have an ephemeral messaging setting set up to auto-delete them after a particular period of time. And so that's where devices such as Celebrate come into play. There is an industry of mobile device forensics tools where the aim of these tools is to recover digital evidence off of a mobile device in a way that is forensically sound and preserves evidence to be presented in court, so it can be used in prosecutions for crimes that are being investigated. That's what the warrant was obtained for. Celebrite is an Israeli company that's probably the best known in this mobile device forensics industry. And so they make tools for automating extracting and indexing data off of mobile devices. They support a range of types of phone and models of phone and versions of mobile operating systems. And they sell not only to U.S. law enforcement, but to governments in less nice countries like the United Arab Emirates and Myanmar and places like that. But at least within the U.S. context, the point is for these devices to give rise to data being pulled off of phones that can then be introduced in evidence in a court case later on. And you might think that if you are in the business of providing some sort of device forensics tools, that you would have pretty decent security, because the last thing you would want would be for there to be some flaw in your device, in your tool, that might undermine the reliability of the data that gets pulled off of it. However, Signal and their leader, Moxie Marlinspike, like showed that this was not the case. They got their hands on a Celebrite tool that they say fell off the back of a truck and basically pulled it apart and looked for vulnerabilities and found quite a lot of low-hanging fruit that would allow somebody who has their phone plugged into a Celebrite device could potentially execute code from their phone that would tamper with the report on that Celebrite generates about the data on that phone, both for that phone and for any reports that had been generated for previous phones that had been analyzed with that Celebrite device and future analyses as well. So this was kind of a bombshell. And it sort of showed, you know, this is, you had one job basically, is to provide data in a forensically sound manner. And if your security is so shoddy that you can't even guarantee that, and if this casts doubt on the reports that are your sole, you know, raison d'etre, then, you know, what are you even in business for? This was all kind of in retribution, basically, for Celebrite adding support for pulling and processing signal data from open and unlocked phones as part of that kind of an analysis, which they had kind of a very puff piece type of announcement for it that made it sound like there was some sort of leet hacking involved, when in fact it just, you know, was the equivalent of like, well, if you have somebody's phone unlocked and in your hand, then you can get data off of it. You know, okay, big deal, right? And so it seems like it was kind of not necessarily in the spirit of like, we attained one of every single kind of the mobile device forensics tools now on the market, and we pulled them all apart, and here's our compare and contrast of all of the vulns we found after engaging in responsible vulnerability disclosure to all of the respective developers. You know, instead, it was just sort of like, we're going to get you back. And, you know, this is what came out of it. It sounds like Celebrite has at least stanched the bleeding. They at least implemented some sort of emergency patch that may not have fixed all of the underlying vulnerabilities, but at least allegedly was going to put a stop to the immediate problem pretty soon after Signal published this blog post about what they had found. I don't know what the current state is in terms of getting up to date, but you have to imagine that if you are getting irate phone calls from all around the country from your various law enforcement customers, you probably have the incentive to fix your stuff pretty quickly.
It also shows that, you know, for these messaging apps, that there's still a war to be waged, you know, as it relates to privacy in general. Like, do you see this kind of thing playing out between private parties going forward? I mean, like, you know, WhatsApp has their own issues in terms of, you know, everybody knows about, you know, how they were, you know, when they were acquired by Facebook. I guess you could also, you're probably more familiar with it than I am, but it basically, you know, it allowed Facebook to review, you know, some of that data and in a way that wasn't available before. And a lot of people were up in arms. So you sort of have WhatsApp look like they weren't as private as they used to be. And Signal came in and others came in and said, hey, we are private. And they made that sort of, you know, a big selling piece of using Signal.
Yeah, it's been fascinating to see this. You know, we've been talking about privacy this whole time, and we've really seen businesses competing on privacy for, you know, several years now. Apple, for example, has really held itself out there as being extremely privacy protective on behalf of its users. And so in other types of services and devices, we've already seen various companies competing with each other to hold themselves out as being the most privacy friendly for their consumers, right? And so it's been interesting to see how that has been playing out now in the end-to-end encrypted chat app space. Like, it's nice that there are enough entrance in that space that they can, you know, be competing with each other on these issues, and to where there are incentives now to be seen as the most privacy protective and the most secure just for average people, right? I mean, the irony, you mentioned WhatsApp. WhatsApp turned on end-to-end encryption by default 5 years ago by implementing the Signal protocol. So some of the same, you know, if you lift up the hood, you'll see some of the same inner workings within WhatsApp as you do within Signal. But they come out in different places in terms of what kind of features do they have? How much data do they keep about you? How much data do they log about you? Is that able to be handed over, you know, from backups to law enforcement? What kinds of usability, where do they fall on a usability versus security scale? I mentioned earlier that a lot of the early software for encrypting your email, for example, was not particularly usable. And the usability revolution for encrypted software, I think, has been one of the drivers in having it be so adopted. If it just works, you don't have to think about it, and it's turned on by default. But, you know, traditionally Signal has come out a bit more on the security side of things and a little bit less on usability. And so if you don't have your messages backed up because, you know, Signal doesn't necessarily do that automatically. And you lose, you know, your last text message conversation with your grandma before she passes away, it's gone, you know? And so I think there are reasons for different apps to make different choices in terms of usability, in terms of security, in terms of how much data do they want to keep and hand over to law enforcement, or how much do they want to investigate and look for and deal with abusive uses of their app, which, you know, are going to happen even if the majority of users are just engaging in normal, innocuous, perfectly legal conduct with their friends and loved ones and business associates. So it's nice to see that there is this competition. I don't know, getting back to your question about like how well do Americans understand all of these issues, I don't know if I even have like a good like handy chart. And there have been efforts, you know, to publish sort of comparisons among these different apps of like, okay, well, what exactly does this mean, you know, in terms of what gets protected, what doesn't, what can I do? What does the backups look like? You know, what do they do if I report abuse? Can I report abuse? All of those different considerations. And, you know, whenever there is some sort of PR nightmare that comes out about one or the other of these apps, you know, most recently about WhatsApp potentially derogating the usability of the app at all for the central purposes of communicating with people, if you didn't agree to Facebook's terms of service, that's the kind of thing that sees a huge drive in downloads of not only of Signal, but of other apps such as Telegram, which has been critiqued for not having as good of encryption under the hood as the Signal protocol. And that's not necessarily something that people are going to understand. You know, people, I think, are driven by people want privacy, but they're going to be driven by like usability. Does it have the things I want, like stickers and emojis and so on? And are my friends using it? Because I have like 5 or 6 different like chat apps of some kind on my phone, and I have to use them with different people. You know, there's only one person who regularly messages me on Discord, but I have Discord installed on there so that when they message me, you know, that's where I get it. And on the other hand, there's, you know, 2 people that use WhatsApp, and then other people that use Signal, and then some other people with iPhones have iMessage. And so the network effects for these kinds of apps can be very powerful. And that's kind of the, you know, the secret weapon, or not so secret weapon, that WhatsApp has, is that it's used by billions of people. And Facebook, its parent company, is used by billions of people. And so that's going to be kind of where people go. And so once you achieve that sort of scale, you have to start asking yourself, I guess, some very serious questions about what it is that you owe to your users. If you are sort of the 800-pound gorilla in the room, to whom are you responsible and for what when it comes to making sure that people don't have to know or think about all of the messy details and policy issues and legal issues and technical issues when they just want to talk to each other?
And so shifting from a sort of a peer-to-peer encrypted messaging system to a public messaging system like Twitter, for example, you've also written about Section 230 immunity. And there's certainly been a lot of challenges to it, like, you know, in terms of the investigations underlying the Capitol riots and different user groups being shut off of Twitter. Or I think, didn't I read somewhere that Nigeria just banned Twitter? I mean, you know, obviously that's not a Section 230, but it sort of raises, you know, sort of this issue as to the role of public messaging apps. What some of your, you know, what have you been following in terms of narrowing the Section 230 immunity from liability for, I guess, postings on a platform, and maybe share some of the thoughts and some of the things you're watching in that regard?
Yeah. So, I mean, there are a lot of proposals to somehow narrow the immunity that Section 230 provides for providers of online services from being liable for the things that their users say and do on the service. The Earn It bill that we talked about earlier was one of those that would have removed Section 230 immunity with respect to child sex trafficking offenses. And of the different proposals that have come along, you know, a lot of them seem to not necessarily grapple adequately with the unintended consequences of what happens when you either mandate some kind of moderation or prohibit some kind of moderation. You know, the internet certainly is not a fun place to be anymore, I think a lot of people would say, compared to the idealistic vision that maybe we had in the 90s of what that would look like. But it is impossible to do content moderation perfectly at scale and please everybody. Basically, everybody wants you to take down the speech they don't like and leave up the speech that they do like. And we just haven't found a way, weirdly enough, of codifying that into statutory language to amend Section 230. But, you know, I think when you try and guide people through sort of a day in the life of the people who have to implement these content moderation policies that almost every online service has, because nobody wants to be a cesspool. Well, most places don't want to be a cesspool, so they're going to do something. I think, you know, once you show people real use cases, and this is something that Mike Masnick from TechDirt, for example, has done a good job of, you sort of get people to understand the nuances and the difficulty of trying to implement a policy, create a policy, see around the corner to see what the next thing is going to be that you don't even have a policy for yet, and how to make decisions that are often very context dependent. And of course, you mentioned public versus private platforms. The challenges of doing content moderation in encrypted spaces look totally different from what you can do when everything is out in the open. So, you know, so many of the proposals seem to boil down to either just some blatantly unconstitutional requirements to carry all, you know, speech protected by the First Amendment, which is itself a First Amendment violation because compelled speech is itself unconstitutional, or they risk solidifying and freezing in amber a particular set of ways of dealing with particular known challenges within online platforms when it comes to content moderation, without allowing the flexibility either to respond nimbly when some new threat comes down the pipe that's making your users miserable, or to update your practices and change your policies as the types of misuse of your service evolve and change. So I haven't yet seen a bill that I love. I've seen plenty to dislike, and you know, my colleagues at SIO and elsewhere at Stanford, including my colleague Daphne Keller, who's a top expert on Section 230 issues, have had a lot of critiques of those bills. And I'm not yet ready to throw up my hands and say there's nowhere around the edges that we could tweak to make things a little better. I just haven't seen anything yet that doesn't carry with it a lot of downside, not necessarily the guarantee of getting the expected upside to even happen.
And I guess maybe another thing to touch on in that context is like going back to the encrypted. So India proposed some traceability regulations that, and WhatsApp had a response. So the traceability meaning the ability to, and maybe you could develop a little bit on what those traceability regulations are, but it seems to really go well beyond the pale of what we would deem to be acceptable, even from a, you know, from a more apathetic US perspective. And maybe you could, I know you've written about that, maybe you could develop a little bit on that.
Sure. So India has something kind of similar to our Section 230 regime in terms of providing a certain safe harbor for intermediaries, you know, social media, app makers, tech companies, et cetera, for what their users say and do. But they have recently revised those rules after, you know, dithering over them for several years to basically mandate that you have to be able to trace out messages and find the original sender of a particular message on a service in order to be eligible for this immunity from liability under Indian law. And so if there are particular serious crimes, if there's a threat to the national security, India wants for the government to be able to go to Facebook or to, you know, whichever service provider. And so you have to find who was the first person that sent this message, because you know, this kind of goes back to the, you know, you shouldn't go after the platform, you should go after the user. It's the user who should be on the hook for what they said and did. And this is India saying, okay, well, help us find the user. We don't want to go after you. We just want you to help us find the user who's responsible for saying this unlawful thing on the internet, whether that's defamation or, you know, from what we've seen from the Narendra Modi government, whether that's saying something critical of the government's response to COVID-19 or journalism about the massive farmers' protests that are going on over there. And so the concern is that the traceability requirement is incompatible with end-to-end encryption, because how are you supposed to be able to figure out everybody who said a particular message if you can't see that message? And so, you know, there are various proposals going back and forth over whether there is some implementation that could be made that would allow for uncovering people who sent a particular message without needing to know what the message is. But, you know, nevertheless, even if there were some technical way of having your cake and eating it too in that degree, it would violate sort of the privacy guarantees that we expect from end-to-end encrypted messaging apps, in that you are supposed to be able to feel certain that government and the provider of the app, that none of those people, no outsiders, will be able to identify you as having said a particular thing, much less everybody in a chain. And one of the special concerns is that if you're trying to trace back and figure out who originally sent a message, that anything to do that would necessarily also expose everybody who had sent it as an intermediary in that chain of, you know, for example, a message that gets forwarded or sent around, and that could be used maliciously by, you know, the person at the end to uncover everybody that sent something in between, if there's something that's very sensitive, such as, you know, a gathering of a persecuted political dissident group or people who belong to a sexual or gender minority and who pass along information. All it takes is somebody malicious at the end to pass it along to authorities and unmask the identities of all of those people who had been intermediaries along the way in terms of passing that message along. And so the privacy threat to that is something that I think that I see as the free expression threat I see as irresolvable, even if there is some way of being able to identify who sent a message without ever seeing what the message is. So the technical aspects, I think, don't address all of the policy aspects.
Right. And certainly it seems like something you could also construct a workaround. I mean, you could assume somebody else's identity. In some ways, it almost seems like the anti-money laundering of messaging, you know, like the origin of the funds, the origin of the messages. I hope we don't get to that point. So, well, we've covered a lot today. And thanks so much for coming on the episode. Anything else you want to touch on? Maybe something that's, you know, top of mind, something that you're focusing on more recently that you'd like to share?
Well, hopefully by the end of this summer or in early fall, I'll be able to publish the results of survey research that I'm doing right now that investigates how providers of online services, websites, and apps, and so forth, conduct their trust and safety efforts to detect and mitigate abuse in ways that don't depend upon guaranteed access to the contents of communications. What are companies doing? What are apps doing that work to fight abuse, that mostly work on metadata or on user reporting? I just finished taking responses to that survey, and hopefully I can analyze that and report out those results within the next few months. And then I also want to make sure I get in a plug for the Internet Observatory's two-year report that just came out. We have only been around for 2 years now, but we've gotten a lot done. And the report is a great overview of all of that we've been working on, which goes so far beyond encryption into election integrity and foreign influence operations and vaccine misinformation and all kinds of things that we don't have the time to get into here. But you can go to io.stanford.edu to find that report.
Right. And we'll drop it in the show notes as well. And in terms of finding the Internet Observatory, the Center for Internet and Society, and yourself online, where should people go?
So you can find me online. I'm probably way too online on Twitter most of the time. I am at @Rihanna_crypto. And the Stanford Internet Observatory is at Stanford.io.
Great. Well, thanks so much for coming on the show. This was it was fantastic to have you on. And like I said, we need to, you know, I think the encrypted economy needs to have more people like you on the show to kind of balance everything else out. So thanks so much for coming on.
It's been a pleasure. Thanks for having me. This has been a lot of fun.